We're going to go ahead and get started. It is exactly 10:15 on my watch, or now 10:16. So thank you for attending session 221, titled Ask a Sex Therapist. This session is generously sponsored by Symmetry Solutions. Are you or is someone you love facing a faith transition that is affecting your relationship and other areas of your life? Are you LGBT plus and looking for services that will support your journey? Do you have sexuality concerns, or are you looking for a sex-positive perspective? Are you dealing with mental health concerns and looking for a qualified therapist? Symmetry Solutions can help. Symmetry Wellness Therapists can do free ecclesiastical consultations, offer group and individual therapy, and work with your insurance. Visit www.symmetrysolutions.com for more information. About this session, sexuality is a taboo topic, both within the general population and Mormon culture, with sexual shame being a common factor among many of its members. This session gives attendants access to the expertise of one of Mormonism's few AASECT. I'm going to go ahead and say what that stands for, because I looked that up. That's American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. So certified sex therapist. Attendees can ask questions directly or anonymously in a safe space. Addressing sexuality openly is a healing component to the healthy sexual journeys we all deserve and crave. Natasha Helfer Parker, LCMFT, clinical marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist, is the owner and founder of Symmetry Solutions and an ASECT certified sex therapist. She's been in practice for over 20 years and works with adults and adolescents. She specializes in mental health therapy, sex therapy, and sexuality concerns, family and couple services, and faith transitions within spiritual journeys. I'll turn the time over to her.
Thank you. I'm surprised anybody's here. I mean, I'm against, like, what, Love Loud? And anyway, talking about sex. And I'm highly distressed that this is only an hour long. It should be, like, 5 hours. So at least that's what I think. Not that there's anything wrong with quickies, but, you know, I'm just saying that's my preference. So thank you for introducing me. I just want to say a little bit about my credentials. So, you know, I went to school to become a marriage and family therapist. And, you know, marriage implies sexuality, I think, for most people. And so you'd think I would have been really well trained in sex. And it was really interesting as I became trained as a sexual therapist, how many things I had to really kind of rethink, how many biases I realized was in my MFT training that wasn't necessarily supported by the sexology field. And this CST is not like a weekend accreditation, okay? It took me like 3 years to get that CST. And not all sex therapists are alike, and there's nobody regulating sex therapy. So just because somebody calls themselves a sex therapist does not mean that they went through this type of training. So I just want to point that out. There's also Christian sex therapy accreditation, which guess how that comes out too? Christian sex therapist. So be very aware of what credentials mean, because you'll get a lot of different kind of perspectives. And what's interesting in the mental health profession is that we disagree greatly about sexuality depending on what type of training we have. And I will just say, as an MFT, which I still love my training as an MFT for many other reasons, I had to really step back and, you know, rethink a lot of my own biases. And of course, you know, growing up Mormon and all of that as well. So a lot of my own work that I've had to do. A few just disclosures and expectations so that we can make this hopefully a very beneficial meeting for all of us. So I will not be addressing sexual trauma in any way, shape, or form that I think sexual trauma should be addressed today. That doesn't mean that you can't ask a question about sexual trauma. At the same time, I just want you to know that I think sexual trauma is its own category where I think that needs its own space. And we did do a session on that yesterday. But So, you know, just to be aware of the complexities of sexual trauma. And along with that, anytime we talk about sexuality, and especially in a room where there's more than two people, I always state that probably about half of us in this room had an unwanted sexual encounter before the age of 18. And so sexual trauma is very prevalent in our story as a human, you know, as a human people. And so if we come up with triggers or if things come up for you that are uncomfortable, I kind of expect that. And I tell people to kind of think about their discomfort on a scale from 1 to 10, where 1 is like, I'm a little bit uncomfortable, I'm not sure I agree with her, with a 10 being like full-blown panic attack, right, or something along those lines. If you're at a 6 to a 10, please do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself, leave the room, throw a stress ball at me, whatever you want to do. We have stress balls out at the Symmetry Solutions table. But if you're at a 1 to 5, I would encourage you to sit with discomfort, because I'm guessing most of us came from Mormon background, and what were we told sexual discomfort comes from? Satan, right? So that's something I really want to challenge, because discomfort, what really is about, not that there aren't dangers that sometimes we are uncomfortable with, but what discomfort is usually really about is about novelty. So anytime we're doing something new or changing our minds about something or having to be challenged in the way we think about something, we're going to have some discomfort. And so I want you to kind of sit with that and think about what that discomfort means for you. So that's my invitation. I've bifocal new contacts. I can't see my own presentation. Just letting you know that. The step in, step out. You know, be aware that we have a short amount of time. Keep your questions kind of quick and succinct in your comments as possible. If you've made more than two comments, it's probably somebody else's turn to make comments. If you're the type of person who usually doesn't like to speak up, that discomfort maybe can propel you to actually speak up. And I do have an anonymous way that you can ask questions as well. And if by any chance because sometimes when I get nervous, I talk a lot. So if you're doing that, I will probably gently, with a big smile on my face in a non-shaming way, interrupt you and try to get you more on task. So please don't take offense to that. It really just is a timing issue. If I could, I'd love to spend an hour with each of you, you know, individually. Confidentiality. So this isn't group therapy. At the same time, I think it would be nice if we could all agree that, you know, at the next ward conference, we don't say, oh, I saw Sister So-and-so at the sex therapist, and this is what she asked about, you know, blah, blah, blah. So Mormonism is a small world, and post-Mormonism is a small world, so just try to keep this as confidential as we can to this group setting. And the last thing I'll say is, please don't use me as a club back home. So it's not like, well, Natasha said that, you know, high sexual libido is perfectly normal, therefore, you know, you better get on the ball and give me all the sex I want, or Natasha is a porn lover, or Natasha is this, or I mean, I've heard it all, I'm everything. I'm like, wait, what did I say that made you think that? So I will normalize a lot of things, but that doesn't mean that you get to use me as a club. So now, yeah, any questions so far? Okay. I am very passionate about sexuality, so I have way too many projects, and I do a kind of a poor job at managing all of them, hopefully somewhat well. And but these are all the things that I'm trying to get the word out. So I have the Mormon Mental Health Podcast that I'm a host of from the Open Stories Foundation, and I would say probably about a quarter of the podcasts on there have something to do with sexuality. That's a free podcast. Donations are always welcome. Mormon Sex Info Podcast is one where I really focused on inviting mostly national and international professionals to talk to a Mormon audience about sexuality. It's amazing contact. Content. Thank you. It's amazing content. And I do ask, that's paid content for the most part. There are a few free episodes. Sex Talk with Natasha is a new subscription that I've just started, which is kind of an adult interactional kind of way that you can kind of see your sexual journey as an ongoing thing, that you're constantly being, you know, I'm giving you daily actions, I'm giving you Facebook Live events. Those happen every Wednesday night, and half of them are free, so if you just want to check that out, check that out. Symmetry Solutions is my online practice where you can actually see me or some of my other providers for sex therapy. And then I just published a book. Ah, okay. So, and I'll sign it for you because I'm not tired of that yet. I hear you might get tired of that. I don't think that's going to happen. All right. So, and then I have, so this is my cell phone. And so what I'm going to try to do is kind of switch from somebody coming up to the mic and asking a question to then I'm going to check my cell phone and see if somebody asked me a question anonymously. So this is how you can tell me, you know, I don't necessarily want to come up to the mic or tell you who I am, but I'd like to ask you this question. Okay, so let's get started. And I don't know what's coming my way today, so this is always exciting. I'm a little hypomanic, and so this is very exciting for me to not know if you're going to stump me or not. So, yeah, anybody who wants to come up, please do so. My brain is yours. Consensually.
Hi, so my question is for adolescents.
Yes.
So, with teenagers and having kids get into pornography and being taught the way I was taught, I'm trying to think of solutions because I don't believe in the pornography industry, especially for kids. I think it like objectifies women personally. So, but at the same time, I don't want them to have all the shame and all the baggage attached. So what are some maybe, I don't know strategies I can use talking with my kids to help say the focus that I don't believe, you know, like, and I've been clear with them, like I told, you know, but have had some instances, but at the same time, I want to know how I can address it without shaming.
Okay, great. Thank you. The first thing that comes to mind is the porn literacy checklist that Marty Klein kind of came up with for to be able to talk to adolescents about sexually explicit materials, which is the term I prefer to use versus pornography because it's very morally laden. He did an interview with me on Mormon Sex Info, so that was a great interview. And you can Google pornography literacy checklist, Marty Klein, and you should be able to find it. I think it's on Your Tango. The main idea around adolescence and sexually explicit material that I try to really talk to parents about is this idea that it's adult entertainment is really what it is. It's not meant for minors. And, you know, most adolescents have driven a car with you since they were babies, right? And so when they go to see Fast and Furious, they kind of understand that that's probably not how most people drive a car, right? But when they go and see sexually explicit materials, because hopefully they're not in the bedroom with you watching you have sex, that's a whole nother issue if they are, then there's not a lot of context, right, for them to understand what's realistic, what's entertainment. And so it's really important to share with them how the industry works in the sense that it's very much like the movie industry, you know, where there's lighting and there's certain body images that are acceptable or not acceptable as far as how people look, which is very similar to Hollywood, right, as far as what bodies get considered sexy and what bodies don't get considered sexy. It's usually very unrealistic in the sense of how the bodies are coming together, all of that. As far as objectification, I would just like to challenge that a little bit because we, although I wouldn't say that the pornography industry is not objectifying, and it is very usually male-centric, although there's many feminist producers of sexually explicit materials now and queer producers, so there's a lot more variety out there than ever before. We objectify as a culture, and I don't see the same, I would say, moral outcry about lipstick or the clothing that is sold or industries where there's a lot of objectification either of women or of minors or a lot of those things. So I just want to just invite you all to think that because sexuality is so taboo, anything around the sex industry usually comes with it a much more moral outcry than some of the same issues we see in other industries. And these days, actually, believe it or not, amateur pornography is giving the industry quite a run for its money, because guess what? We like to show off as a people. So lots of people are making their own porn, and it's free. And so a lot of the porn industries are actually having to have really good contracts, and actually a lot of them make a point of that. So again, it's not black and white. There's obviously a lot of criminal things going on in those worlds, just like there are in most business worlds. So I just would encourage you to just kind of take a step back and say, okay, how much of this outcry is because of sexual anxiety versus dynamics that happen in business and an objectification of people in general? So that would be my only thought about that. But it is important, I think, to talk to kids. Now, we don't want to shame kids, and the whole, you know, porn is going to kill your brain, I think, is very shaming. So we want to normalize that they're going to see things, but you also want to, I think, offer a lot of supplemental material. Because if kids get very quick the notion of whether or not you're safe to come to with these questions or these ideas, and porn does continue to be the number one sexual educator of our minors. So how open you are and what other types of materials you are willing to give your children, the guide to getting it on. I'm still in an argument with my husband about whether or not I can give that to my kids, but I will win. And because I'm like, they're seeing worse things on the porn, whether you want to, you know, address it or not. And so I think that it's important that we are very willing to be comprehensive sexual educators of our children, which means a lot more than anatomy. It really means about pleasure, consent, and helping them navigate their sexuality where they're at, because they will be sexual more than likely. And in this country, kids are having sexual experiences, which means penis and vagina sex, by the time that they're 17. Whereas in other countries, that's more in the early 20s, like in countries that offer comprehensive sexual education. But that doesn't mean that those kids are not being sexual. They're just finding other ways to be sexual that are not as risky as penis and vagina sex. And I love the loopholes our Mormon kids come up with, right? Because, you know, they're like, I'm a virgin, Sister Parker. And I'm like, great, what does that mean? Well, you know, I suck dick and I have anal sex, but I'm a virgin. And I'm like, oh, okay, because those things aren't risky, right? And I'm sure you're super knowledgeable about how to have anal sex at 15. So we want to make sure, too, that we don't put so much emphasis on a certain type of virginity.
Piggybacking on speaking with adolescents, I'm worried about the messages. I've stepped away from the church, but my wife continues to go and take her kids. And so I'm worried about the messages my kids are going to be receiving about certain things. My oldest daughter is 12, about to turn 13. My oldest son is 8, about to turn 9. And maybe I defer to my wife to talk with the girls, but I'm a little worried about what I tell my sons. I know specifically I didn't like how it was handled. Like when you discover masturbation either having to keep that completely secret and not talk about it, or if you did talk about it, the shame that a lot of people feel from the church. And so I guess looking for tips about, I feel stumped sometimes if I should be, how proactive, or do I wait for them to come to me, or, and then what to say to my kids about healthy sexuality.
Great. Well, I'm always going to choose proactive. And I also think it's really important to not play the gender card. So boys need to hear from their moms and girls need to hear from their dads, you know, if you happen to have a mom or a dad. So, because I think it's important to have messages from both parents. Believe it or not, kids do listen to parents. You probably won't know this until they're in their 30s. But they do. So, you know, the research on drugs and alcohol and things like that show that parents' opinions matter. And even if they do experiment with some of those things in their teens, which is fairly normal, they'll usually come back to kind of some of those teachings or ideas that the parents had. So I think if kids are still attending church, it can be very powerful to have parents in the home saying something like, well, you know, there's lots of ways to Mormon, and when Sister So-and-so just said something like, you know, the object lesson or whatever, we're not the types of Mormons that buy into that, right? So we're the types of Mormons that think that sexuality is a gift from God and something that you're going to have to explore, and if you make mistakes, well, we're kind of here to make mistakes, and you're going to learn from that, and just because it doesn't follow the Mormon kind of very... maybe more rigid way of following the rules, your experiences will matter, and maybe some of them will even be pleasurable, even if you still feel they're sinful or things like that. So, you know, you complicate things for your kids in your home, and you advocate for them. You know, so in my home, for example, we don't allow for bishops' interviews or worthiness interviews that deal with sexually explicit questions way before the Sam Young thing happened. I'm also very upfront that if the lessons are going to be about sexuality, I either want to be present or I decide to pull my kids out. We never go to the standards firesides. Those are usually a disaster. So, and I tell my kids why, right? So we talk. Now, kids are supposed to rebel because that's what they're supposed to be doing to get ready to launch from you. You are supposed to be stupid from the ages of 12 to 17. The parents are supposed to be stupid, is what I'm saying. and you're not supposed to know anything. Because if they don't have some level of that, how are they supposed to leave the security of their home? So developmentally, that's very normal. So a lot of parents, I think, who are post-Mormon or transitioning Mormons or nuanced Mormons are worried that the ward home is going to have more influence than they will at home. And especially if you're in a mixed faith marriage, right? So now you have one parent and the ward versus the other parent. So what I will say to that is, again, have conversations without a lot of your own defensiveness, because kids will react to that. And at the same time, I would say, well, because I have one of these kids who just chose to be ordained, and you know, I think Sister McDavid is probably a better mom than me right now, those kinds of things, right? So, but there are worse things. There are worse things than my kid rebelling against me towards Mormonism, right? I mean, there's gangs and cocaine and, you know, like, there are worse things, right? So I just try to go with that flow and honor his spiritual journey as his own, you know, as he comes to find these things out. And when he comes to me and says things like, Mom, we're not that bad with the gays, which right now I'm like, how's one of my kids saying the gays? But anyway, it's like, because I went to EFY, you know, or whatever, and they said that we love everybody. And I'm like, And so I try not to just jump into, but this is why. I really try to validate that. Like, oh, that's really great. And what was that like for you to hear that? And then after a few minutes, I'll say something like, and I think it's important for you to know that we have this policy that happened, and so that's why I'm upset about it. So it's kind of like the yes and, right? Because as soon as you challenge, well, what happens? You know, it's like you're here, and you're here, and then somebody says something, and you're like, oh, no, and so this person backs up from you, right? And then you back up, and then you back up, and it's like all of a sudden you're really polarized. So try not to do that with your adolescents. Okay, I'm going to take a text question. I think I got one. Oh, my, I got a lot of them. Shoot. stop. Maybe this isn't a good idea. All right, how would you help partners reconcile different life and sexual energy levels? Okay, so as a sex therapist, I would say the two most common things that come into my office are different libidos, which that means different levels of sexual desire, and also different erotic templates, which means different things turn you on from what turns me on. And the construct of monogamy, this gets a little bit difficult because it's not like, oh, you don't like book club? Well, I'll just go to book club with my friends, right? So, oh, you don't like oral sex? I'll just get that taken care of over here. Most of us are not comfortable with that kind of contract, right? Some are entering non-monogamous relationships for these kinds of reasons, and that's one way to manage things, but most people in our current culture, and I'm not just talking about Mormonism, are not comfortable with that. So then you have to really kind of manage the tension between what I call systemic authenticity and individual authenticity, right? So individual authenticity is I matter, my needs matter, you know, what I want or what I think about or what turns me on matters, or my libido, wherever it's at, matters. And your all of that on your end matters too, right? So how do I negotiate kind of advocating for myself and also leaning into compromise, which can be very difficult if you don't feel like something sexually turns you on. How do I compromise doing something that I don't feel comfortable with or that maybe makes me nauseous or, you know, things of that nature? One of the tips I'll give you is just these struggles typically show up in a blaming way in my room. And the two ways that people tend to blame is they blame themselves. There's something wrong with me. You know, I'm too frigid. I'm hypersexual. I'm an addict. I'm suppressed. Whatever those things are. Or they blame their partner. You're an addict. You're suppressed. You know, you're too frigid. You know, you're perverse, right? All these things. And so we get stuck in this blame game that leaves usually both people feeling pretty awful about themselves and their relationship, and really ignores how libido and erotic preferences even develop to begin with, which are highly, mostly subconscious things that you have very little control over. Like, you know, I feel so bad for men with erectile dysfunction. It's like, you know, what's the message that women have been given in our sexual narrative in this country is you're supposed to be sexually alluring. And if you are, guess what will happen? Right? He'll get an erection. So if he's not getting an erection, what must that mean? I'm not sexually alluring enough. I'm not turning you on. Et cetera, right? And so, and women, we have, guess what, just as much erectile tissue as men. It's just more hidden. So you can't tell that we are also getting erect. But, and so women oftentimes will hide whether or not they're aroused because there's this, you know, feeling of either duty or I don't want to hurt his feelings. I'm talking heterosexually here, right? So, And sometimes we'll push through a lot of painful intercourse. I mean, there's just some really sad stories that really come from a lack of sexual education, which is, first of all, you have zero control over your arousal mechanism. You can't say, okay, get lubricated right now. Okay, get hard right now. You can't do that. So you're dealing with a part of your body that is not going to function that way. Two, you have very little control about what turns you on, and so your desire. Now, there are things that you can do to kind of help yourself, you know, have different cognitions or things like that to help that over time, but it's not like one day from the next you're just going to be like, yep, I want lower libido, or I want higher libido, so I just told my brain that, so it's going to happen, right? And so when you're negotiating this as a couple, there's a lot of potential for pain if you don't understand that. So you really need to back up and first of all just normalize where you're at. Wherever you're at, there's no right type of libido. There's no right type of erotic preference. Even things that turn you on that might freak you out, like a rape fantasy or a fetish or dominant submissive types of eroticism. Maybe that doesn't fit with your value system. Like, I don't want to rape anybody, or I don't want to be raped, so why is this turning me on? Your erotic preferences could care less about your values. They could care less about them. And this is why fantasy is so important. And what have we been taught in Mormonism is that your thoughts are equal to what? Your actions. I'm like, no. If there's anything that Jesus supposedly says in the scriptures, I'm like, no. To that one. Because I'd much rather you think about raping me than raping me, please. Okay, so just think about that all you want. Just don't do it. So it's not equal, right? It's not equal. And fantasy world is a way that you can negotiate a lot of things in your, if you have, you know, a trusting, somewhat healthy relationship, where you're never going to step into the real world with those things. But in the context of your relationship, if you can trust yourself and be playful and creative, you can come up with a lot of ways to compromise things. So that's a very long answer to a question because it is very complex. But I hope those are some tips anyway. I'll ask one more. Oh, yeah, come up. I guess we're going to prefer the people who come up. So that's a discrimination. How about that? All right, go ahead.
Right. So there's a Utah Coalition Against Pornography. Mm-hmm. There's also now NCAP, National Coalition Against Pornography. Mm-hmm. As citizens, how do we approach that? Is there a way to help the system of government say that pornography is not a public health hazard?
I really struggle with this, with the air quality here, as to why we're so focused on porn as the health crisis, but I detract. I you know, if you're, a lot of my podcasts, first of all, have some of the premier professionals that will help you understand why this isn't a public health crisis. And that doesn't mean, again, that I'm like pro-porn or that porn is wonderful or that it always helps people. I think, like most things, the thing in of itself is not necessarily bad or good. It's how it's used, right? So I can say that, I mean, missionary style position is probably the number one way sexual assault happens. Where's the panic about missionary style position? Right? Why aren't we having a missionary style position health crisis? So same goes with masturbation, right? So same goes with pornography. For some people, having a sexually explicit materials that they have ethically purchased, that's a good way to control whether or not you're falling into ethical or materials where, you know, you've had a where there's been some type of exploitation. And just two books that I'll give you really fast that are David Lay is The Myth of Sex Addiction, so educate yourself. And two is, I don't love this this title, but it's Ethical Porn for Dicks. Even he said, I had the Gentleman's Guide, and they didn't like that. They thought Ethical Porn for Dicks would sell better. I'm like, okay. So anyway, but it's a really good read if you're worried about the ethical aspects of the industry, and I think many of us are, so that's a good one to be aware of. So educate yourself, be willing to advocate, speak up at your school boards when they have like Sons of Helaman or the Fight the New Drug or things like that that actually you're paying quite a bit of your monies to. They're not cheap. They charge more than I do to come speak to your children. Please, please advocate against that. Raise awareness in whatever way, shape, or form you can. The reality is that, and Joshua Grubbs out of Bowling Green University has done excellent research on who are the people that are most concerned about the epidemic, and it's religious people. So these are issues. These are porn. Fight the New Drug is not showing up in like the San Francisco school system. They'd be laughed out of the water. But they are showing up in the Book of Mormon Belt, and they're showing up in the Bible Belt, which is where I'm from. Please don't think these are Mormon issues. Like, I can topple you on the Mormon issues by 100% where I'm from. So we have lots of sex addiction clinics, you know, evangelical therapists practicing unethically. Sons of Helaman is one of the most unethical practices. If any of you are, I mean, I can't place a complaint to the board because I'm not their client. But if you've ever been part of that treatment center, you can place complaints with the regulatory boards, you know, in each state. We wrote letters to the Utah Board of Education. Their responses were extremely interesting about how porn fights the new drug is not sexual education. Because sexual education, you actually have to have a lot of, you have to get a lot of parent permission and board permission to do anything in sexual education. And Fight the New Drug just comes in and offers these trainings. Well, it's because it's not sex education. I'm like, huh? So, yeah. All right, I'll ask another question here. How can I tell if it's low libido or my prudish, fearful, shame-inducing upbringing that makes me somewhat apathetic towards sex? Yeah, so a lot of that is, it is complex to know if you've got some type of biological kind of issue going on. You know, hormones are a big part of whether or not we experience libido and arousal. Remember, arousal is different from desire, right? Arousal is what your body's doing. Desire is what your brain is doing, right? So your brain may want sex, but you're not having arousal. Or you may have arousal when you don't want sex, right? This is why some people, when they're sexually assaulted, will actually have an orgasm or will get erect if it's a male. That's arousal happening, not necessarily because they want it, but because we don't know that, people get very confused and feel a lot of guilt and shame when those kinds of things happen. Anyway, so if you have low libido, one of the first things I recommend is go get a checkup. You know, go get your hormones checked. You know, talk to your OBGYN about, or your physicians about what's going on. A lot of times, especially for men, but remember, women have the same type of erectile function, is there's some type of cardio issue going on, diabetes, things like that. So blood isn't getting to the places that it should be getting to in the way it should. But a lot of it, I think, is if you're in a space where it doesn't really matter and you don't care too much, I'm not going to say you have to have, you know, you have to work on this. Sexuality does come with a lot of sex or health benefits, so we know it helps both pleasure and climax help with a lot of things. It helps with pain relief, it helps with cardiovascular health, it helps with certain types of cancer, especially for men, prostate cancer, et cetera. It helps with, I don't know, there's like such a big list. It helps with stress relief, you know, like just emotional health as well. So it is a benefit to you. But I don't want to say, oh, you should work on this if it's not something that you feel very important about and it's not interfering in your relationship, in your primary relationship. But if it's something that you're like, you know, maybe I would like to see if I have more potential to enjoy my sexuality, and I do come from kind of a repressed culture, and not just Mormonism, but, you know, the United States has a lot of weird messages about sex. So I'd like to maybe step into that realm. What I will say is that you have to kind of practice it. It's kind of like when I go to the gym. You know, when I started working out, I went to a Zumba class, I went to a boxing class, I went to a yoga class. I decided, you know what, I don't like that kind, I like this kind. I started seeing results, but only after practice and time. And the first few times, I wasn't that excited about it. So, you know, you kind of have to decide if you're willing to put that type of energy into it. I think one of the myths we have in society about sex is it's just supposed to spontaneously happen. Fireworks are supposed to just align, and everything's just supposed to organically happen. And a lot of things in life are not like that. And if you want to further your education or further, you know, your skill in anything, you usually have to learn about it, and you usually have to practice it. And sex is no different. So be willing to kind of step into that space. And then I want to leave you. We have 5 minutes. Oh, I'm so sad. I want to leave you with the thoughts of spontaneous. Oh, I do. Oh, I have 20 minutes. Oh, this is so orgasmic right now. Okay. 20 minutes with you all. All right, so thank you. Spontaneous desire versus responsive desire. These are two very important things to understand. A person who writes about this really well is Emily Nagoski with the book Come As You Are. I did an interview with her on Mormon Sex Info. Excellent book and excellent interview. And so spontaneous desire is that idea that, you know, when you're horny, like your body's kind of telling you, you know, I'm ready for something to happen. And guess what you usually do when that happens? You look at your partner, right? If you're in a partnership and, hey, I'm kind of ready for something to happen. Aren't you? At the same exact moment I am? Which is another myth we're told in the movies, right? Like, in the movies, it's like, oh, right away, everybody's moaning in the same exact way, and we're all orgasming in the same moment, and usually about 10 minutes after we met each other, and it's very exciting. So that's super realistic. So anyway, but the other type of desire, which is actually the much more common desire, is responsive desire, which means you're not in the mood, but there's this... something is happening that is inviting you to get into the mood. And if you're willing to say, well, okay, maybe I'm willing to see what might happen, or maybe I'm not willing to have sex with you right now, but I'm willing for you to give me a back rub, right? Or I'm willing to cuddle with you, or I'm willing to do something along those lines. And in the middle of that, your body's like, maybe... we could go further, right? And so that's responsive desire. So I don't know how much my husband loves about how much I share about my sex life, but he's just going to have to forgive me. And but for example, one of the things that I like to think about when I am invited to a sexual encounter is, where am I at? And if I'm at a hard no, it's a no. That's okay. I mean, it's okay to say no, and it's okay to have strategies on how you're going to deal with those rejections that don't have to feel like rejections. It's just we're in a different space. So it's good to reframe that. And it's good to have strategies on what a person can do. So, you know, can masturbation be part of your contract together? Again, I'm not going to blame masturbation for relationship issues. Masturbation in secret and against contracts can be harmful. Masturbation where everybody understands what's going on and help, and we've decided it's going to help our libido differences, can actually be amazing. Is that masturbation's fault? No, that's your contracting issues or non-contracting issues. So, you know, but if I'm kind of like, you know what? I enjoy the fact that you find me attractive, and I enjoy the fact that when you're horny, you turn to me. And I like watching your pleasure. That's pleasurable to me, right? So I want to be very pleasure-focused, not orgasm-focused. So if I can watch you get turned on, and if I can help you get turned on, that brings me pleasure. For me. I'm not saying that always is for everybody, but for me, that happens. So I'm willing to engage. But I'm very clear with him. I'm like, I'm kind of in quickie mode. I'd love to help you out. Come here, you know, flirtatious, and we have a nice encounter that usually lasts about 3 minutes, okay? So that's great. He's happy. I'm happy. Remember, this is not duty sex. That's very different. I'm not coming at it from the perspective of, oh, no, I have to, or that's not healthy, and your vagina will go like this. Your vagina doesn't know it's married to the person that you love. Your penis doesn't know that either. So if you're doing things up here that they're not in agreement with, you're going to have problems the next time because they're going to remember that. They're going to be like, we don't like this. So why do you keep doing it, right? So listen to your body. But anyway, if I'm in that space where my vagina is still happy, then we're good. Now, sometimes, about minute two, I'm like, oh. I'm like, slow down. Quickie time is over. And then, you know, we're going to go into the 20 minutes that I need typically to get to the point where we want to go. So, but that's stuff we've negotiated, right? And contracted and talked about, which most of us have very little skill set on because none of us were taught these types of skills. But anyway, that's my responsive desire kicking in. Does that make sense? Okay. I went way too long because I was excited I had 20 minutes left. Let me ask another question, and then if somebody wants to come up. So other than shame, what do you find to be the biggest challenges for Mormons when it comes to sex, and how about for post or ex-Mormons? I think shame is the big one. Don't take a picture of me while I'm having a moment with my throat. Okay, now. No. So, he always catches me at the worst moments. So I think shame is a big one because it really, it's shame and it's misinformation. And those two combined are just a doozy. And what I would say, too, is that we learn these things. And so what you're doing right now is you're having an intellectual moment with me. And I'm hoping that you'll walk away from this session with a few aha moments, right? Like a few things that are like, oh, yeah, that applies to me. Or, oh, that's maybe a way I can think about that differently. And then you're going to go, and you're going to go be sexual. And guess what happens in the middle, right before you're having an orgasm, is something interrupts, and you're like, why? Why did I just not have this amazing moment with Natasha and thought through something super helpful, and now something is getting in the way of what I was hoping to enjoy, right? Well, that's because this part is just like 10% of the work that you have to do. The rest of the part is, and that's why we do sex therapy, right, and why it's longer. It's not just education. I mean, education is part usually of therapy. But that's just the beginning part, because then you actually have to practice, and you have to use mindfulness, and you have to learn how to deal with those moments when intrusive thoughts interrupt you, or your body doesn't respond the way you hoped, or how to, you know, not be as disappointed if you don't reach orgasm, but you still had a lot of pleasure. So these are the things that we're wanting to relearn. And that's the part, if you think about it, how many years did you spend in Shameville, right? Or in these spaces where you had misinformation. And not that it's going to take equal amounts of time. It's not that, you know, depressing. But it is going to take some time. You know, usually 6 months to 2 years is kind of the projection I give for people to relearn, to rewire some of these things that we've learned along the way. And so that takes things that we typically don't like, consistency, practice, you know, we want immediate results. And so I really encourage all of you to see your sexuality as an ongoing journey. I think one of the other things that we tend to struggle with in Mormonism is black and white thinking. And it doesn't matter where you're at on the Mormon spectrum as far as believer or not, you take that with you. I'm just letting you know. So people can be very black and white, you know, when they're believers, it's like anything outside of marriage is super bad and sinful. When you're non-believers, you're like, I missed out on every possible sexual opportunity I could have had, and I would have been so much better. And I'm just letting you know that I work with lots of people who've had premarital sex and lots of people who aren't Mormons, and they're pretty much just as messed up as we all are. So please don't buy into these, you know, narratives that somehow if you hadn't grown up Mormon, you still would have grown up in the United States, more than likely. I don't know any place in the world other than maybe Sweden and Norway and some of these countries, and it's just recently that they've been doing better, where there isn't some level of sexual shame, lots of sexual narratives that are affected by culture, by family of origin, by trauma, you know, by religion. So we're all kind of in this together. And I do think that if you're in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, you're in a really great space to rethink some of those things for yourself. And hopefully you can look at enjoying your sexuality until you die, because we're sexual beings throughout. We have a lot of ageist type of myths around sexuality as well. You know, that when you hit menopause, you're going to lose your desire. If you, you know, if you, as you get older, your libido shouldn't, you know, we desexualize older people all the time. And there are some things that are affected by age on that, but the good news is that the number one place that is having STI problems is in nursing homes. So that's the good news, is that they're still very sexually active. The bad news is that they need comprehensive sexual education too. So anyway, anybody want to come up? Yes.
So my husband and I stopped attending the Mormon church a few years ago, but how do we raise sex-positive children without giving permission for them to be having sexual experiences when they're not developmentally ready for those?
Okay. So right away, I will say that we have a lot of biases on what we think is developmentally ready to have sexual experiences. And I will say that the number one thing that's most painful is narratives. So if you tell a kid, if you have sex before you're developmentally ready, or when before you're married, or whatever, before you want it, it will harm you. It will harm you. You will be more emotionally attached to the person that you're having sex with. It will be harder to have a breakup. You will share with something with them that you'll never get back. Versus saying a narrative like, sexuality is kind of part of you stepping into an adult world, you know, and right now as a teenager, you're not yet an adult, but you're not a little kid either, so you're going to start thinking about sexuality and having maybe some sexual experiences. We, as your parents, are hopeful that blah, 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 whatever your values are. And at the same time, if you do have some sexual experiences, we hope that you use those as learning opportunities. You may have some things you regret. You may have some things that you enjoy. That's a very different narrative. And self-fulfilling prophecies are very powerful. So a lot of the shame and guilt kids feel are because we've taught them to feel the shame and guilt. I had sex when I was 15. That kind of cringes me right now because I have 15-year-olds. At the time, I thought it was amazing. It didn't ruin me. I'm sure it affected me. I had a positive experience, thank goodness. Not everybody does, but not everybody does when they're 22 either, right? And so I think we need to be a little careful that we don't get too rigid about at what point kids start exploring with that. What we can also really teach kids is responsibility and what I call it's the six principles of sexual health, which I've done in a complete series on Mormon Sex Info on each principle with Doug Braun Harvey, who's an amazing psychotherapist and educator in the sex field. So those would be consent and enthusiastic consent, really teaching kids about consent. Non-exploitation, which immediately people think sex trafficking, and I'm like, no, these are guilt trips. Oh, I've got the blue balls. What am I going to do? That's exploitation. And we do it in our marriages all the time. We don't like to think we're exploitive, right? But when we don't get our way, that's hard. So we get grumpy, pouty. So we can become exploitative. Protection from unwanted pregnancy and STIs, which is most of the education they're getting in their school systems is focused on that. But it's abstinence-based for the most part in our country. So make sure they have access and knowledge about that. And I usually recommend two forms of birth control. Honesty, shared values, and mutual pleasure. Okay, and remember, pleasure doesn't equal or have to equal orgasm. So I'm going to give you just a quick 6 minutes. A quick example of two very kind of exaggerated ways that people do or do not follow these six principles that would kind of go against what we would normally think. So you've got the couple at church, they're sitting in the pews every week, they've got their six kids, they're temple recommend holders, you know, they're in their presidencies, they seem like the ideal family. She's had genital pain since their honeymoon, never really told him about it, so right there you've got honesty issues. So she just kind of grits through it. She, of course, rejects a lot of sexuality because of that. He becomes exploitative and grumpy and threatens things. Mutual pleasure is not happening. He just quickly has orgasms, but that's dissatisfying to him too because he would prefer, you know, more desire, but he's still going along with this kind of subpar sex, so why is he doing that, right? But they're married. Isn't that what healthy sexuality is? You waited until you were married, right? They're married in the temple. They were virgins before they got married. They should be having the best sex of their lives, right? Lie. You lie. That's from one of those movies. Okay, I digress. Anyway, so then you've got two college kids, right? They're heading into finals. They're about to graduate. They're headed into different directions. One of them is going to go do graduate work on the East Coast. One of them has a job on the West Coast. They've been friends throughout their college experience. One of them says, hey, you know, I'm kind of stressed out, and I've always kind of, you know, liked you, and, you know, would you be into, you know, doing something together? And is that something that you'd be into? If not, that's fine. You know, I just thought I'd hit you up, right? And the other person's like, actually, that would be so much fun, right? And they talk about birth control, and it doesn't go against either of their values to have kind of a hookup experience. They're not using substances in ways that would interfere with consent. And they both make sure, you know, he comes first, but then he makes sure to get the vibrator out and make sure she reaches orgasm as well. But we're all freaking out because, oh my gosh, there's hookup culture. Now, I'm not saying there aren't problems with hookup culture. It usually has to do a lot with alcohol. But I'm just saying, do you see the difference, how those sexual principles don't have to follow any one narrative, right? And how are we using them in our relationships? And don't just assume that monogamous marital relationships are healthy and non-monogamous or more casual relationships are unhealthy. Okay. I think I'm going to take one more through this. Which one do I want to do? How do you define modesty? I define it as spending money correctly. interest in exploring open marriage, how do I get over extreme jealousy, and it goes directly into how I view my self-worth and why I'm not enough. Okay, so first of all, I'm just going to say something very quickly about non-monogamy, because that's a whole other presentation that I actually did here a few years ago, so I can do that again if people want. Tell me and I'll make sure I present that again. So I want to be very clear that I don't think non-monogamy is more elevated or mature or better than monogamy. Okay, these are just tastes and differences. And it can be a tool that some people find very useful. I have found in post-Mormonism that it's a tool that's usually prematurely used in ways that don't end up helping the relationship. That's not non-monogamy's fault. That's your fault for not taking the time or getting the professional help or contracting sufficiently to make something like that work. And sometimes you don't know if something's going to work until you try it. So you need to have exploratory ways of thinking about things. You know, we may try this for a few months. We may step back from it. What is it going to mean? Oftentimes, with the partner who's most interested in it ends up not being the one who has most success in it. Then sometimes the other partner has liked it. Now we've got another type of problem. So I'm just saying it's messy, but it's not necessarily undoable. And there's lots of ways that people negotiate non-monogamy really well. But that takes work and practice and getting accurate information about it. So I wouldn't want anybody to ever feel like I have to make this work, right? Or if I don't make this work, that somehow that makes me a jealous, immature person. You have a right to your boundaries, just like your partner. And sometimes these become boundaries that people decide we're sexually maybe incompatible or we can't continue in this relationship. And that's okay, too. I just, again, would hope you don't do that prematurely. And I would hope that you get some professional help from people who are not going to, you know, who are trained in those types of themes. But again, the other thing I'll say to this is, again, the myth of monogamy. We live in a monogamy privileged world where we have a lot of myths about how sexuality should work. And this whole idea that I belong to you and you belong to me creates a lot of potential for power dynamics around sexuality that are not healthy for either one of you. And the narrative, again, given mostly to women, is that the main thing that you are valuable for is your sex appeal. And that is a huge way we objectify women. So if my male or female partner is interested in somebody else or finds somebody else attractive, even just the attractive part, which is fairly normal, most of us find other people attractive, for women, that hits right to my self-identity. That must mean I'm not enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not sexy enough. Every billboard out there, every advertisement, every movie is telling women you are not enough. Every product that you buy is telling you you're not enough. So when you've got a partner who finds somebody else attractive or who maybe even wants to have sexual experiences with another person, that is deep, deep, deeply ingrained. And so there's potential, whether you're interested in monogamy or non-monogamy, to really work on that piece so that you can feel more free, that it's not that I belong to you or you belong to me. It's like, I belong to me. I belong to me. Now I'm going to figure out how I want to share me with you. And you get to figure out how you're going to share you with me. That's a very different contract than now I get to be upset about or control your sexuality versus how are we going to manage our sexualities together. So I think that's probably a good place to end. I went a minute over. Took me just a little longer. Oh, and I wanted to tell you, just because I think it's funny, that you can all say, you saw my vulva today. Hello. Yes, it was that kind of a session. Thank you so much for coming. I hope this was helpful.